Who is that?
Jazz.
Bastard.
Hey, just a short message to let you know that this Jazz Bastard podcast departs from our usual format. It will be a sustained interview with Charles McPherson, the alto saxophone player. If you'd like to learn more about Charles, you can look up www.charlesmcpherson.com. That lists what music of his is currently available to purchase, where his upcoming gigs will be, and provides some biographical background information. Just to hit a couple highlights, Charles' most recent recording from 2015 on Capri Records is The Journey, and it's one of his favorites, so he recommends you take a listen to that. We enjoyed it too. He's also got a gig coming up at Dizzy's Club Coca-Cola in March 2018, so you might want to catch him there live, or perhaps on satellite radio, which carries many of those shows. He has an ongoing collaboration with the San Diego Ballet and resides in San Diego, so you can see some of his work there. Again, for further details, try www.charlesmcpherson.com. We really enjoyed this interview and hope you do too. Tune in next time for our return to our usual format.
This is Mike. This is podcast number 132. And as our listeners will know, from time to time we have guests on to talk about their projects or to talk about their work. Our guest today is someone we probably don't have enough time in just one podcast to talk about the body of work and the various people with whom he's been associated with in a very long and distinguished career in jazz. But Pat and I are super excited to welcome to the podcast today the very fine and still vibrantly performing alto saxophonist, Charles McPherson. Charles, say hi.
Yeah, hello. Thank you.
Cool. And Pat, say hi too. I don't want to leave you out.
Hi. I'm Pat.
This is Pat. I'm Mike. And that's Charles. So when we have guests on, we often will ask them to give us suggestions about music we should listen to as a way of thinking about where they came from and their career. And Charles kindly did that for us today. But I thought maybe we could just start. I'd just ask you, Charles, to tell us a little bit about yourself and to tell our listeners where you come from and where you kind of got into the music. You're born in Missouri, right? Joplin?
Yes, that's right. I was born in Joplin, Missouri, and I stayed there up until I was about 9 years old. That's where I did get a chance to hear some of the territorial bands that would come through Joplin during that time.
They were big enough to, I mean, Joplin was big enough to have bands?
Joplin was a fairly big town. I mean, you had Kansas City, Kansas. You had Kansas City, Missouri. If you go straight down, the next big, you know, and then there's Springfield, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, there's Joplin. So Joplin going is south of Kansas City.
It's on the west side of Missouri,
yeah.
Right?
So, yeah. Okay. Southwest Missouri. It borders Northwest Arkansas.
Right.
Also, a little bit to the west would be Oklahoma.
And
that. So that's the part. And it was a town, a fairly big town. And so it would be on the travel route of bands. And during those days, they had what they called territorial bands. Now, this is where I live would be considered South Central.
Mm-hmm.
United States, or just a little more south of middle.
Yeah.
So those bands, there were people like Jay McShann and all of the bands that are from Oklahoma and Kansas City and all those kind of great musicians from those areas that had bands, big and small, they would travel all around, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas City. So I probably heard some of these bands and didn't know since I was so young. I'm like 6, 7, 8 years old.
Parents taking you to these?
In the summertime, there was a park in Joplin and in my neighborhood where that every August they would have live bands coming and to play like a weekend. And these bands, now I know enough to say those were probably people like Andy Kirk, Jay McShann. And some of those other territorial bands.
And that was your first exposure to
jazz?
Yeah,
that was really? My exposure to jazz, looking at people play, big bands, and, the shiny gold instruments.
Right.
That was for me, plus the sound of the music and just the event itself was a very positive, happy event. It's in a park, everybody's there, and the music is playing. So that impressed me.
Mm. Did you start playing then in Joplin or when you moved to Detroit?
Yeah, I started playing later in Detroit. So I moved from there in 1948, and I moved to Detroit. I had relatives there. My mother had a sister there and brothers. And so we moved there. And I was just, I didn't start playing music until I was about 12. And I got in the band at school. I guess it would be junior high school. I started playing trumpet first for about a year. I wanted to play saxophone, but I didn't own one. And the school had instruments, but there were none. All the saxophones were already out. Some kids already had them. So I had to wait a year. I played trumpet, flugelhorn. And then a year later, at 13, I got an alto saxophone. And I basically just played, band music, marches, for, little things like that, just traditional junior high school band music, which would be John Philip Sousa and, marches and that kind of thing. And I started listening to jazz, and the jazz I listened to would be big bands. There were people like, I didn't know about Duke Ellington and people like Johnny Hodges, and there were some rhythm and blues saxophone players that I knew about. So I knew a little. I did have a liking of that kind of music, jazz and blues and all that stuff. Big bands. I knew about Tommy Dorsey and people like that. So those people were very popular during the late 40s. And so I did know a little bit. However, when I started playing at 13, a young saxophone player that was maybe a year older than I told me about Charlie Parker. I had never heard of Charlie Parker, and I had never heard Charlie Parker. All right, so I was apprised of Charlie Parker by this older young man who played tenor.
Mm-hmm.
So, days later, whenever, I did get a chance to hear Charlie Parker on the jukebox.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, those days we had jukeboxes, and so you put a nickel or a dime in and you hear, all these records or whatever you want. And it was like, oh, here's this Charlie Parker that this guy was telling me about. Let me hear this. And so the first record I ever heard of Charlie Parker was Charlie Parker playing Tico Tico. Which is part of a series of records he made with Norman Granz, probably Verve, and these are either Mercury, those labels. And it was a series of records Bird made called South of the Border. It was a Latin-based, Cuban, Afro-Cuban, Latin-based music with Charlie Parker. So it would be people like Machito and different of these salsa players that lived in New York. And Bird made a few records with them that were very pretty popular and extremely good records. So the first one I heard was Tico Tico. And I don't know if you're familiar with that. But okay, well, then it was just – immediately it spoke to me, and I'm like 14 years old, 13, 14 year old kid. For whatever reason, I got it. It spoke to me right away, and it was like, who is this? What kind of music is this? Who else plays like this? So I wanted to know everything about that. So now I want to know everything about Charlie Parker. I want to hear every record he made. So I get into Charlie Parker. And, you know, I learned more and I started going to the record shops in my neighborhood and browsing in the jazz department. Of course, there's a bunch of Charlie Parker records. So I get deep into him. And then I find out there's a whole genre of players that play in the mode of Charlie Parker. He's one of many that play what at that time we called progressive jazz.
It didn't have the label bebop at that
point. Well, bebop too. Bebop and progressive jazz were all part of kind of the same umbrella. Well, the other people would be Dizzy Gillespie, Clifford Brown, Miles Davis. We considered Stan Kenton and the big band part of what we called modern music, modern jazz music.
Right.
Bebop was a part of modern jazz music.
So besides Parker, were there other alto players that really affected you when you were that young?
Not so much. I mean, Sonny Stitt, of course. Mm-hmm. Much like Charlie Parker in a way.
Yeah. And
so I started listening to all players that played this genre of music. Charlie Parker, but also tenor players, other alto, anybody that played this way, piano players, just the whole that new music, which was new at the time. I was very interested in it. So everybody that played this kind of music and all of the different diverse styles that can happen in that music there, I was just very much into it. So everybody, Stan Getz, Chet Baker, Clifford Brown, Charlie Parker, Miles, everybody that played this way.
Right. You told me once that you met Parker when you were a teenager, right, when you met him?
Yeah, I met him, I was about 15. And
This was right after you got into his music.
Yeah, I at this point now, I'm into his music for a year or two.
And so how did that come about? How did you actually meet Charlie Parker?
Well, he played at a ballroom in Detroit, and this ballroom brought a lot of musicians there, not just Bird, but anybody. Mm-hmm. And some of the great jazz players, Max Roach, or just several people. And Bird came one weekend, and so I was there to see Charlie Parker, and so was probably everybody in Detroit that was into jazz music was there to hear Charlie Parker. So I did meet him. I was about 15. He was probably in his, maybe 34, 33, 34 at that time.
How does that come about? Like, you're sort of at a dance hall, and there's Charlie. He's playing. Was he with a big band or a small combo?
He was playing with a local Detroit band. It was a local rhythm section. Bass player, drummer, piano player, local guys. And they weren't really bebop guys. They were more swing guys.
Mm.
But they were very good, though.
Right.
But more, not really, you know, bebop. As per se, you know.
Before I ask you how you met him, what was it like to hear him live?
Because it was incredible.
Records can't really capture what he's like.
No, they can't. They can't capture the sonic part of it, the sound, and of course, Charlie Parker's demeanor and his charisma, they just, if you will, animal magnetism was as thick, you could cut it with a knife. Mm. I've never seen that before. I've never seen it with, let me see. I saw it with Duke Ellington. It's just a certain self-assuredness and a certain regality that's part of the physical ambiance of certain people. It's almost like, you know how Orson Welles looked?
Mm.
Do you ever remember seeing Orson Welles talk?
Sure, sure.
See him on a talk show or John, whatever. Bird's ambiance was like Orson Welles. It was like this extremely smart, self-assured, and almost a regality about him without it being pretentious or affected. You know, this wasn't put on.
Right.
And this was interesting. When I look back on that now, the interesting thing about him, and I'm not even talking about how he sounded, I'm just talking about his presence. He had this presence, but there was no, absolutely no sense of narcissism, which is an interesting mix of this very regal, you know, aristocratic man, but without any ounce of narcissism. Narcissism. You know, it didn't make him any difference what you thought about him or if you were looking at him. I could sense all of that. And this is what actually made his persona even have a more stronger presence, is that he was totally at peace, at ease with who he was. And it didn't make any difference about, it could be 1,000 people staring at him. And believe you me, the way when he entered that ballroom, I heard people say, he's here. And then when that happened, all of a sudden I saw throngs of people rushing to a certain area of the room. And so I made my way over there as well. And as I kind of went through in the middle of the circle of, you know, like at least 100, 200 people, there was Charlie Parker right in the middle getting his horn out. He wasn't even on the bandstand. He was on the floor of the dance floor. He got his horn out. He played like a real fast scale from the bottom of his horn to the top, fast as hell, clean as a whistle, you know, and that was it.
And that's the warm-up.
That was the warm-up. It was just fast and clean as a whistle. And then he just walked and he went on the bandstand, and that was kind of it.
When he played, what was it like? I mean, you know, as a player, did he play to the crowd? Did he look to the crowd? Or was he the kind of guy who played with his eyes closed?
No, he had his eyes open. I remember that. Mm. He had his eyes open. And here again, when he played, there was no feeling of narcissism again. The look on his face and the look coming out of his eyes were total. It's like a person that was totally at one with the instrument. And even though people are there staring, looking at him, and I can see him kind of looking at them, but there's nothing about them that's bothering any part of his concentration. I could tell that even as a little kid.
Mm.
Which was interesting. So he started playing, and he had this big, beautiful sound.
Did they have amplification on him, or did he not need it?
Yeah, it was a mic. He was mic'd, and he wasn't. You know, he was back from the mic a little bit, and he had this beautiful sound and just perfect perfect technique, clean as a whistle. And I could tell his beat, his sense of time was just about as perfect as you could get. I could sense that.
Mm. And it sounds like this was kind of a religious experience almost when you saw him.
Yeah, I guess you could use that word, but it was just an awe. It was awe-inspiring. I had never seen anyone that looked like that. And when he wasn't playing, you know, I did talk to him, you know, when...
Yeah, how did a 15-year-old kid work up the nerve to work up to Parker?
Yeah, he took breaks, you know, he would take break and come off the band, I would just be like a little puppy dog. I would just run up and start asking him questions about his horn and his, what kind of reeds he uses, mouthpiece. You know, I was pretty much probably annoying, but he never was short. He was always courteous. He was approachable. He answered everything I asked him. He did do this, which was interesting. It was hard for him to answer me in a direct way. He would, if I asked him something, he would answer in a poem, which was weird, you know. I remember saying something about, time, and then he started talking about Omar Khayyam. He started quoting, you know, a loaf of bread and some wine and that. I mean, his answers wouldn't be the stock answers. Sometimes it would be, but quite often it would just produce like a poem that he could say that took care of that moment of me asking whatever I ask about.
Huh.
He was like, that was unusual. Yeah. But then sometimes he would just be, it would be a very direct, mundane answer sometimes. But sometimes it would be almost like poetic, you know. And he was all, so that was kind of strange to talk to a man. The look coming out of his eyes were, I can remember this, that it was the most intelligent look I had ever seen coming out of a person. You know, you can look at people's eyes and you get a sense how bright, how many watts that are in there.
Yeah.
You know, if it's 100 watts, if it's 40 watts, you get a sense of that. And you know, the eyes sort of tell it all in a way.
Now, was that the only time you saw him, or did you ever meet him again?
I saw him in person. I saw him on television a couple of times.
Right.
But in person, that was it. And he was extremely just very full of self-confidence. It was thick. And people would be crowding around him. And he didn't seem to care. He had a different kind of ego. It wasn't based on, I need this adoration. It was almost, people did it and he didn't care anything about it. I mean, I could tell it was meaningless to him. He was just who he was. And I remember seeing him roll, you know, in those days, you know, some people, if they wanted to, they could smoke cigarettes and roll like they still do in Europe sometimes. You know, you roll your own cigarette. I remember him rolling his own cigarette with one hand. He had the tobacco and he rolled it with one hand and he did all of that like a magician. Yeah. Just real, what would you call it? Adept. In fact, I heard that he did do tricks with, you know, like coins disappear with his hands. He was into that. Mm-hmm. You know?
Did he have big hands or, you know, I mean, it's a weird question.
Fingers. I don't know if his hands, but his fingers were not short.
Mm.
And
that's a big help, I guess.
Yeah, that, well, I don't think it's a hindrance. That's what it is.
Okay. Right.
So yeah, he did have that one hand, you know, every, you know, movements was like the no wasted motions. Nothing was wasted. If he rolled a cigarette, it was like 3 or 4 moves and the cigarette was rolled, ready to go. I could tell everything, the way he walked, there's nothing wasted. He seemed to have just control over time and space. I don't know. He was really something.
Can I ask, did he make a bigger impression on you? It sounds like he made not just an impression on you as a player, because your own playing, you know, shares characteristics with Parker, but also just as a human being. It seems like you kind of took the measure of him, even on that one meeting, and kind of...
You couldn't help it. You couldn't help, for some reason, the guy, as I say before, whatever the animal magnetism, it was thick. And I later find out it wasn't just me being enamored of somebody like Bird. There's a tenor player named Teddy Edwards. He's dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like Bird's age, maybe a couple years older. But, you know, he was around during that period. And I remember him telling me that if he walked in the house, in some house, and Bird was in that house, he knew Bird was in the house.
Huh.
He could tell. You know, so that's what I mean. This is what I mean.
Right.
Like he could walk in and he could, if Bird was supposed to be there or something, or Bird might be there, he could tell Bird was there. before we saw Barry. Barry might be in the basement of the house or something.
Right. So now how did you go?
Barry was in the house, just the way everybody in the house was acting, just the vibe. Sure.
So how did you go from being, because your own career path, your trajectory kind of takes off as a professional musician in a few short years. And so you're 14 or 15 meeting Charlie Parker.
Right.
And you're gigging professionally in Detroit, what, in a year or two or three?
19. So the next important person for me was Barry Harris, piano player. Barry Harris lived in Detroit and happened to live around the corner from me.
Hmm.
He worked at a jazz club that was also down the street from my house. Very popular local jazz club, with the greatest Detroit musicians working at that club. And the house band was Elvin Jones on drums, Barry on piano, people like Paul Chambers on the bass, Thad Jones on trumpet sometimes, Pepper Adams, baritone player. Billy Mitchell, you know, all of these great jazz musicians that lived in Detroit, they would work at this club.
Did you just get to gig with them? You get to walk in? And
since it was down the street from my house, I had, as I said, I discovered the kind of music I wanted to learn about when I was like 13, 14. When I found out that down the street from my house is a club that features that kind of music exclusively, then that was it for me. I started walking down there, and I'm 14, 15 years old, and I just stand. I'm too young to get in the club. I just stand outside and listen, especially in the summertime. Hmm. And those musicians would take breaks in the summertime and come outside, and that's how I met Barry. And then, Pepper Adams and Elvin, those guys, I met all those guys, and they knew there was, it would not just be me, it would be two or three other young guys, 15 years old, out there listening too. So they knew we were musicians, and they were quite, that was kind of a nice thing for them to see a bunch of guys that young that are into the music like that.
Can I ask you, because every time I talk to you, you mention more names of people that you played with or that you saw sort of up close and personal, and it would take forever to ask you about all the people you've met, but. Yeah. Someone who we've talked about, who we both have, Pat and I both have a lot of admiration for, is Elvin Jones. What kind of a guy was Elvin like?
Well, Elvin was a very nice guy. He was very warm to us. He was Pepper and Elvin were in the war together. I think they were in Korea. So they were really close friends. And Elvin, those guys. So Elvin was very nice, very approachable. We would come and Elvin would be playing the drums and his back would be to the window. That was the window that we could peep in. Back with, you know, the way the drums were set up, his back was to this window, and we could knock on that window. He would turn around, know it's us, and then fix the Venetian blinds so we could see through there.
Because he seemed like such a, you know, his persona, at least when you, as a player, and when you hear stories, he seemed like such kind of a fierce guy. But it sounds like he wasn't really generous.
No, he wasn't. He might have looked like that, but he wasn't. He was not like a, he was a smart guy. He looks like an animal when he's playing the drums. But when you talk to him, then there's a whole nother, he's nothing. And when you hear him talk, he's very smart. He's not like what he looks like when he plays.
And all the Jones boys would come there. Did you meet Hank Jones there too?
No, Hank at that time, who's older than all those Jones brothers, he was already in New York and an established player.
Right.
So this is how I met Barry. Now, one Sunday afternoon, a little trumpet player that's my age lived on my street. We went to this club in the afternoon. They had matinees, and if you had your parents with you, you could come in there. And we set in. We played a couple tunes. We set in. They let us set in. And Miles Davis was working at this club. This is when Miles was living in Detroit for a couple years. And so we set in and played a couple tunes. And they let us do that. And then that was it. And then, of course, Miles and Pepper Adam, Barry Harris, everybody else starts. They play the rest of the matinee. So this is how I connected with Barry. And Barry said, well, you need to know more. You guys are talented. But come by my house sometime. I'll show you about some harmony and theory. And so I started coming by Barry's house. And this is when I began to learn about harmony theory, about chord changes and all of the stuff that you need to know. And he's the one who showed me. And an interesting little side note, Barry Harris, he's still living. He's almost 90 years old, and he still teaches a lot.
Do you keep in touch with him? Do you talk to him?
Not as much as, I call him maybe once a year. I don't see him much. I see him sometimes when I go to New York. But anyway, I used to go to his house all the time. Every day, every other day, I'd go to his house. And so Barry was and still is, like, he's one of these guys that he's very smart. He's he would do the New York Times puzzle in about 20 minutes, and he would do that. That was part of his day. He'd do the puzzle. And he would read. He was well read. He read books. And this is interesting. Also, well, to make a long story short, one day I had my report card with me. I was over to his house and I had my report card, and Barry, he saw the card. He said, hey, let me see your report card. Let me see what kind of grades you get. And I showed him the card, and on the report card, there were all, in this country, they graded A, which is the best, B next. And then C is kind of average.
Mm-hmm.
D, E, and F is not good, and F is failing, So I had a card that with all C's, no A's, no B's, but I didn't have any failing marks, just C's. And he looked at it, and he said, well, that's not so good. And I looked at him, I said, well, what do you mean? Now, he said, well, it looks like you're quite average. And when he said that, I didn't get that he meant that in a demeaning way, but he did.
Mm.
And he said, you can't learn how to play this music and be an average guy. You can't. This music is too complicated. You're going to have to really tighten up your head thing up,
Did that work? Did that, you become
a better student? It worked big time. It worked. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, let me see you do this puzzle. And every word that you don't know, look it up in the dictionary. So he put this puzzle there, and he put a big fat dictionary, and I started to do the puzzle. Now, this is the New York Times puzzle. This is hard.
Yeah.
I'm like 15. I could get some of that stuff. But hell no, I was nowhere near able to do that. But he actually made me do it, look words up, and then he would say, book, you got to start reading, and he recommended certain books. Now, this meant more coming from him than it did from my parents telling me to do better. This is a person that I want to be like Barry. I want to be like Charlie Parker. And when he told me that, man, people like Charlie Parker, these people are brilliant. There is nothing average about these people at all. You're going to have to really get your stuff together to even play like as good as these people can play. And I thought that, well, this is what I got to do to learn how to play. I noticed that when Barry would have musicians come over to his house, because people were always over to his house, other musicians, Pepper, Paul Chambers, these guys would talk about things other than music. And guess what they would talk about? They would talk about Schopenhauer, Immanuel Kant. They would talk about Nietzsche. They would talk about Spinoza. They would talk about Bertrand Russell. They would talk about Gorgiev and Ouspensky. These guys would talk about this. All of them, they would sit down. And I couldn't believe that these guys knew music and could play this well, could actually sit down and talk about things that had nothing to do with music at all, and would be knowledgeable if they talk about it. And then I understood what Barry meant. Mm. It was like, wow, it's not just Barry. All of these cats are very, these guys basically are, I mean, at the risk of sounding elitist, these guys are basically the kind of intellectual guy. These guys are these guys are thinkers. Mm. They're not just some cats, you know, smoking weed and playing. These guys might be smoking weed and playing, but these guys are thinkers also, you know. And then that's when I started really getting serious about school, reading. I started reading Nietzsche. I started reading Schopenhauer and Immanuel Kant. I started reading the Vedas and up and Bhagavad Gita. I started doing that. Right. Now, and when I started doing it, lo and behold, I started being able to do the puzzles, my vocabulary. And in the end, I graduated from high school with being an A student for the last 2 years, me being in high school. So that left an impression on me.
Now, what happened after high school? Did you go to New York right away to start playing? You just knew, if I'm going to play, I got to play there.
First, I played around Detroit for a while, and I played, you know, all the gigs and little stuff. And then I got married pretty young. I got married at 19, and I started. And then at about 20, I went to New York. I saved money to go to New York. And I had enough money to be in New York for 3 or 4 months.
What year is this, by the way?
Oh, this would be 1959.
Okay.
I went to New York, and I'm just floating around. I'm staying with friends, and I got enough money to last for a couple months. And I want to try to get with one of these named bands. And then it turns out that Mingus needed a saxophone player. Needed an alto player, and he needed a trumpet player. And he came by a jam session where we would jam in the afternoon, and he heard Lonnie, trumpet player, and myself.
Not everyone knows, Lonnie Hillier.
Yeah, Lonnie Hillier.
Now, was he from Detroit, too? Was he your buddy from Detroit? Yeah,
he was one of the guys that we went to play at the jam session at the Bluebird. That's the name of that local jazz club in the afternoon. Mm. He was a very talented guy, died young. He died at 45 in 1985. Anyway, at that time, it was Lonnie and I went and worked. We started working with Mingus at a club in the village that night.
Slow down. Hang on a second. Okay. So you're doing an afternoon jam session, and Mingus walks in.
Yeah, Mingus walks in because it was Yusuf Lateef that told Mingus, hey, there's couple young guys from Detroit that would be able to play your music. And the reason why Mingus was interested in that is because Eric Dolphy was the saxophone player in his band at that time, and Eric was quitting.
Oh.
Mingus. And the trumpet player was a guy named Ted Kirsten that was quitting.
So you guys replaced Ted Kirsten and Eric Dolphy?
Yes, that's exactly right. And Mingus was livid. He was livid that Eric especially was quitting him. He hated the fact that he had to get a new people, but he did. So he came to hear us because Yusuf said, these guys set in at a little jam session in the village every afternoon. Go by and hear them and see if you like them and then see what happens. So Mingus did do that. He heard us. He hired us for that night at a club.
And when he came in, did you know he was like checking you out or you were just playing?
Yeah, I think I knew, or either he told us. Mm-hmm. Or either he said, hey, Yusuf told me about you guys, and do you guys want a gig? Yes, we do. And so he said, well, meet it, come to this club, you know, in the village. So he gave us the name of the club and where it is. And we went there that night. Now, the first night on the – now, Eric is still in the band, and so is the trumpet player. In those days, you gave 2 weeks' notice before you actually quit. And in the 2 weeks, you stayed in the band and showed the new people the music.
That so Eric Dolphy tutored you.
Yes, and so did the trumpet player tutor the other guy.
Holy shit. Not, sorry.
Yeah, that's kind of the way it was done. I mean, you know, you gave a notice – 2 weeks, and then you do that. So for 2 weeks, you know, Mingus had two saxophone players and two trumpet players.
What was it like being tutored by, you know, by being kind of sitting in with Eric Dolphy? What was
Well, it was, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, really, Mingus is, because we had to read this music. I mean, we're reading the music. And so tutored maybe is a maybe too strong a word. But, you know, you learn from watching, you know, people play.
Right.
I could read your music. We could kind of read Mingus's music. But, you know, the how things went down and nuance and all of that stuff, that's when you, the tutoring, or you just watch what happens. And, you know, and so we did do that. Now, on the night, the first night of the gig, Mingus is still very mad at Eric that he's quitting. And it also, he had an issue with the club owner also. The club owner owed Mingus about $2,000. Didn't have the money. So Mingus got angry and started tearing the piano up. He went inside of the piano and starts plugging the plugs out. I mean, the strings out, if you can believe that.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so he's 5'11", you know, he's about 41 years old. He weighed 300 pounds. He had a reputation of you know, hitting, you know, beating musicians up that didn't play his music.
Right.
You know, beating club owners up. I mean, we were terrified of him. You know, we were 19, 20 years old.
This is your first night. This is your first night
on the gig, and this is what happens. He tears the piano up, and the guys who own this club are gangsters. 101 gang, Hollywood gangsters.
Oh,
you know,
man.
I mean, it was like a Hollywood 101 casting. Flat out, just like in movies. I thought we all would get killed. After this, because he's tearing up this piano, and these guys are walking around and they're strapped. I mean, these guys are thugs. I know. And instead of it turning into what I thought it might turn into, they were so awestruck with a guy that was so enraged, they just looked at him do it. And they didn't do anything. And he did what he thought was $2,000 worth of damage, and then he stopped. And it was like. So he, you know, he didn't tear the whole piano up. He just pulled a few strings out, you know.
Oh.
And then he stopped, and then that kind of dissipated. Now we're in the lobby of the club. Now he turns his anger to Eric, and he wants to kill Eric. You can't quit me. You can't do this to me. And he tells Eric to get his knife out. And he pulls a knife out, and he pulls this knife out, Mingus, you know. And he tells Eric, we're both going to die here. Put your knife out. Get your knife out. And in those days, some guys carried knives, you know. And Eric looked at him and smiled and said, Mingus, I don't have a knife. So Mingus said, wait a minute. I'll go across the street. I'll buy you one. So he goes across the street to this candy store, buys his cheap knife and comes back and gives it to Eric. And Eric just says, come on, Mingus. You know, Eric was this real nice, genteel, very nice, warm, smart, educated man. You know, he wasn't about to do it. He looked at Mingus as if he was a childish, you know. He's like, come on, Mingus. And Mingus wasn't going to do none of that anyway. But it's just all the hyperbole and just the drama of it all. And, of course, nothing happened, and that was the end of that. But that was the first night on the gig for me and this other young trumpet player. And I looked at Lonnie, my friend, after all of this, and I looked at him and I said, we auditioned to get this gig, and we got the gig, and this is who we're working for. And this is what he's doing. He just tore a piano up. And he just threatened to cut to death the saxophone player. Are we supposed to be happy we got this gig or what?
So that was your introduction to New York.
That was my introduction to Mingus, and I actually ended up staying with him for 12 years.
How did that? I mean,
well, after that, you know, it was okay. So the gigs start pretty soon. Eric and those guys, they leave, and it's just Lonnie, myself, and you know, Danny Richmond, the drummer, and Mingus.
Danny was with him basically forever, right?
Yeah, he was. He was. Yeah. And then, you know, Mingus had different piano players. I think it was a guy named Wade Leakey. Might have been the piano player at that time. So I got a chance to know Mingus better, and I learned some things about him, which is interesting. We played, there was a friend of, we were in Palo Alto. We call it Mill Valley. It's in the San Francisco Bay Area. And there was a famous poet named Kenneth Patchen. I don't know if you guys ever heard of him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Kenneth Patchen, he was kind of along the lines of Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg, those kind of people. Okay, so it was Kenneth Patchen, who was a personal friend of Mingus. And he was sick, and he didn't have any money. So Mingus did a benefit concert for him. So there was a little benefit concert for him at a big coffee house in Palo Alto, Mill Valley, California. So at the end of the gig, Mingus started handing out $5 bills to the band just to give them something, because the money raised was really for this guy's hospital costs. Mm. So everybody in the band took the money, you know, just $5. He just wanted to give us something. And when he got to me, I just looked at the $5 and I said, well, I mean, what is $5 going to do? It's not going to do anything. So just give it to, since we're doing this, just give the $5 and give it to him. Put it in the kitty for him, for Kenneth Patchen. And when I did that, Mingus looked at me and his eyes welled up with tears. He teared up a little bit and he just said, thanks, Charlie. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And he put the money in. But in his mind, I stood out from everybody in the band because they all took the money. Mm. And when he came to me, I just said, what is $5 in the first place? Give it to him. He needs it. And he never forgot that. And he, you know, as I said, he teared up. And from that point on, I could do no wrong. Mm. I could be late. He would just turn his head. He wouldn't say anything. I could be acting silly and ridiculous on the bandstand because I was young. He would play like he didn't hear it. So he categorized me as a nice spirit and different. And so he never bothered me. Never. Hmm. He always held me in a certain kind of respect, like I was kind of special to him. And that let me know, as cantankerous, as confrontational, and aggressive as he could be, there was a part of him that if he felt you were genuine as a human, that resonated with him. Mm. And he treated you differently if he felt that about you.
Right.
So he had a heart, actually.
Right.
You know, in this gruff exterior.
Can I ask you what it was like going from the music of Parker to the music of Mingus? Was that a big leap or a big kind of change for you?
Yeah, it was to some extent, because Mingus loved Charlie Parker. So he loved that. But he loved Duke Ellington. So Mingus, basically, if I were to come up with 10 words or less to describe stylistically what Mingus was about musically, is a combination of Charlie Parker and Duke Ellington. Hmm. These were his heroes. And so there was the Duke Ellington part, you know, the whole big band, that whole scene. And the way Mingus wrote was, you know, he definitely borrowed from Duke Ellington in ways. But also he's kind of from that bebop. He's that age of the bebop era. And so he partook of that too. So it's So the Charlie Parker part I was okay with, and I was at home with that part. The Duke Ellington part, I had to really kind of learn that. I had to learn that and be get an understanding of that, because that was a little different for me. But I did, though. So most of, I was with Mingus for 12 years off and on, but pretty much 12 years. And then in 1972, I started working with my own group as a leader in the late 60s.
Right.
And I started working with making my own records under my own name, hitting my own band. And by 72, I was pretty much through working with Mingus. And I did do one last record date. I think it was Mingus's last record date. It was 1978. It was a record date he did with a big band. And Joni Mitchell had something to do with this record date. I think she produced it. Mm. It might have been a couple of her tunes on there or something also. But this big man was everybody in New York. It was Michael Brecker, Randy Brecker, George Coleman, Lee Konitz, Larry Carriel, myself, their piano player. You know, it was all of the kind of names that were in New York were in this record date. It was Mingus's last record date. He was in a wheelchair. You know, he died of what they call Lou Gehrig's disease. Their technical name is myotrophic lateral sclerosis. It's a weird disease where you all your nerve endings deteriorate and you eventually suffocate, because it takes muscles to even take a breath. You get to the point that you can't even blink or raise your hand, and you can't even take a breath, and you die of suffocation. Some people live longer because there are different variations of disease. That astrophysicist Stephen Hawking.
Right.
Hawking has that also. Okay, so Mingus actually ended up dying with that. And so 78 was his last record date. It was my last day in New York. I think it was February, something like that, or March in 1978, my last day. And from that, after that record date, the next day I went to San Diego, because my mom still lived there by herself. I'm starting to worry about her being old, and she's not married. She's by herself, and I'm starting getting concerned about her falling and all this stuff. You worry about your parents, as you get older.
When you came out here, did that make it? Didn't Mingus go down to Mexico for some alternative treatments and stuff? Yes. Did that make it easy for you to? Did you go down and see him in Mexico?
I did not, and he did that, and I think he lasted another year or so, but he passed on. But no, I just went because I only saw my mother once a year when I'd tour and be in L.A. or something. I would see her, but now I'm thinking once a year is not enough. I'm gonna have to go visit her and just see how she's dealing with old age. So I go with the intentions of not living in San Diego. I just go to hang out with her for, a couple months. And then I ended up staying. I ended up getting married. And so that was it.
Right. That's, you met Lynn here, right?
Yeah, I met my wife, my current wife here. And I did at that time want to get away from New York. I wanted to. I smoked cigarettes in those days. I wanted to stop smoking. I wanted to stop drinking. I wanted to just get away from, let me go to San Diego, nice weather, hang out with my mom, stop all of this fast life bullshit, and let me take stock of myself, think about what I want to do and all this. And so I did. I went out there, went to San Diego. I stopped smoking. I stopped drinking. I just kind of got my head together, and I'm hanging out with my mom, and then I end up staying.
Pat, I've been monopolizing the conversation. There's some stuff you want to ask Charles about, what we've been talking about so far?
Well, it's been great. I've really been kind of transfixed by the stories, and I guess I don't know whether we want to start talking a little bit about your career in the studios, Charles, and some of the projects you did both early on and more recently. Is that where we should shift?
It's good. I'm ready for you. I wrote down some tunes. You know, I wrote down some tunes that, you know, records that I've done that, you know, if you want to talk about some of that, that's fine.
Sure.
Awesome. Maybe you could walk us through, I know you're, I think it was on, was it Prestige Records for a while? Is that correct?
My first record date was, I was on a lot of records with Mingus.
Oh, okay, sure.
So I did a lot of records. You know, I was with him for 12 years. So there's a lot of it's documented. I'm with him on many records that they probably put on, you know, like how they compile compilations and stuff. So I was on a lot of records. Mingus at Monterey was a very well received. Mingus did in 64.
Right.
I was in that band during that. So I first started recording with Mingus on Candid. And then, you know, Mingus was with Columbia, and he was with a lot of different people. Then My Children Hear Music was a very well-received CD that Mingus did. Mingus did a thing at Carnegie Hall with a bunch of musicians. Myself, Gene Ammons, Roland Kurt, a bunch of Perdido is one of the tunes we play. It's kind of a famous record too. But anyway, so there's a lot of documentation with me with Mingus. Now, I started recording with now on records with Barry Harris too. Those would be on Riverside. One of the records I made with Barry, it was on Riverside, it's called Newer Than New. Carmel Jones was on that.
Okay.
Myself, I think a bass player from Detroit named Ernie Farrell, a drummer that's dead now named Clifford Jarvis, very talented drummer during the 60s, young guy at that time. Anyway, that was with Barry and there were a couple of records with him. Then I started with Prestige on that label. Bob Weinstock, the original owner, was selling his catalog to Don Schlitten, which later became Xanadu. So anyway, so I did do a couple of records with Prestige. I think From This Moment On, maybe was one of them.
Yeah, one I picked up recently was McPherson's Mood.
Was that on Prestige? Yes.
Okay. Yeah, well, Wikipedia is claiming it is. I don't have the album in my lap right now. But that's
right. Probably right. McPherson's Mood. Let me see. From This Moment On, maybe?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But those were... And then soon after that, Don Schlitten bought that catalog. So I might have done something. Well, he was the producer with some of that Prestige stuff. And then I was with Xanadu, which is Don Schlitten.
Right, his label. We did a show on them, yeah.
Yeah, so I did quite a few with him. And then after that, there was Bob Shad, who... So I did some record with him, and I'm trying to think of the label of...
Oh, Mainstream. Is it Mainstream?
Okay. So I did Today's Man was on Mainstream, Siku Ya Bibi, which means Day of the Lady, and it's a Billie Holiday tribute. So, and then later there was what was the other company? In fact, Pat, you mentioned it.
Arabesque?
Okay, no, it was one before that.
Discovery?
That Discovery, okay. Right. So there stuff on that. But, you know, the things that I like when I think about things that I've done. There's one on Arabesque called Come Play With Me. You know, I like that. I think Mulgrew Miller is on some of that. There's a Tom Harrell is on. There's a one called First Flight.
Yep, got that one.
With Tom Harrell, Michael Weiss and Peter Washington and maybe Victor Lewis. From This Moment On, that might be Prestige. It's an older one. Sakuya BB. That was from mainstream. I like that. Most recently is a one called The Journey. It's on Capri Records.
We have that. Yeah.
We enjoyed that. Yeah.
And then there's one called Clarion, where it's a tribute to Charlie Parker.
So can you say a little bit about, like, for example, can you talk a little bit about your more recent album, The Journey?
Yes.
You know, tell our listeners what it's like for someone such as yourself who's really, you know, deeply influenced at a young age by someone like Parker to develop your own voice and your own mannerisms and your own licks, and yet still kind of play within a tradition that is a recognizable heir to, you know, the tradition that Parker kind of made famous. Like, what is that? What's it like to chart your own space on an album like The Journey?
Yeah, well, this is one of the things that an artist or player has to do. You have to get your own style and find your own notes, say things the way you say them. And this is the individual. So a lot of it is organic. Some of it is just becoming a person. You know, as a person, you can't separate personality and style and nuance as a human being. You can't separate it from the art itself. So a lot of it is just getting in touch with your own inner being. And, you know, identity comes about that way. Some people get that real young. They have that when they're 15, 14, 15. Some people get it later. Some people never get it. But nevertheless, it's got something to do with development as a person. And then to become one, to have your art or whatever your endeavor is, to have it actually be an extension of yourself, that's what's to be desired. So all I've tried to do is, I don't know. That's a hard thing. I actually went back with music and thought of it as a little baby all over again. Looked at scales and looked at the harmony, looked at the 12-tone scale that we have, and just looked at it from square one. And it would just to look at it objectively with just pure consciousness, if I could. So I have actually done certain things on a conscious level of trying to, you know, find your own voice. It's a funny thing. It's very Zen in a way. It's almost an act of non-doing. In the end, it's not like you even try for it. You know, you already are yourself. All you have to do is just not be afraid to just venture out. Just venture. Take the chance, be willing to fail. All of these things, it's a very, you know, interesting psychologically what it is. I have to think about that. But I have tried to, there's a deliberate part of trying. I mean, I can play like Bird. I know Bird's licks. You know, I could, but I deliberately don't go there with them.
Right.
But there are certain similarities that I can't help. I think rhythmically, I feel it the way he feels.
Yeah.
You know, rhythmically. And some of it is organic. You know, I'm from the same part of the country. I'm a different generation, but I'm from the same part of the country he's from. People, you know, in those days, the region you come from influenced how you heard, how you felt music. This is before mass communication. So people from Texas, like tenor players, for instance, or piano players, they tended to sound alike. People from New York had a similar sound. People from the Kansas City had a similar sound. Their take on jazz and how they felt time and space and rhythm wasn't the same as what people in New Orleans felt. People in Boston played. So everybody played differently. You could almost identify certain players. You could almost identify the regions that they maybe came from. There was a certain sound called Texas tenor. Right. Because a lot of, yeah. So I came along. This is before, you know, there's no, hell, it was barely, TV for us didn't happen until 1949, you know, where the average person in the neighborhood had a television set. So there's no such thing as, jazz wasn't taught in schools. It had nothing to do with college curriculums or high school or any of that. So we learned how to play just from people who lived in our area and how they played. So I'm from the same part of the country Charlie Parker's from. There's a certain way that those people feel rhythm that's different than, say, somebody from North Carolina. There's a certain something. And so that might have something to do with things to some point. And then he spoke to me so early on. I understood it so early on that I don't know if it's not something metaphysical attached to any of it. Because, I mean, as you guys well know, the reality is a very many layered things, what we call consciousness and what we call reality. And, you know, when your time and space and how we're all connected might be something other than just the three-dimensional time and space as we tend to think. It could be there's a lot of stuff going on with who we are as human beings. So why would Charlie Parker speak to me so thoroughly at such a young age, 13, 14 years old? One could think about that. So there's a kinship with him some sort of way. But anyway, I think I've developed enough of my own way to be different enough from him. And if I played another instrument, if I played trumpet or tenor or something, people might not even think about comparing me with him. Because Charlie Parker was such a strong influence that he influenced everybody from 1940 on. Didn't make, you know, alto players sort of get the comparison is made because you're playing the same instrument the guy played. But trumpet players, if I were to transpose a trumpet solo from Clifford Brown, for instance, and transferred it to alto, it would sound like Charlie Parker to a great extent. And so would the trombone players. So with the piano players, so with the tenor players. When we think of John Coltrane, especially the Coltrane with Miles Davis before he went to his modal thing, it's just another version of Charlie Parker, a little bit different, but on tenor and not alto. It's similar. If you listen to some of the records Coltrane did make on alto, you hear he sounds like Charlie Parker to a certain extent. So Charlie Parker was just so overwhelming in terms of an influence that he got everybody, including arrangers and people, you know, who arrange and orchestrate. It was just that's how influential he was. But the name of the game is to get your own way of speaking and your own voice. And hopefully I'm getting that or have at least some uniqueness.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Charles, I really enjoy all your playing, but some of the ballads really leapt out for me. And there's an ongoing discussion. You know, some players say that when they play a ballad, they want to think of the lyrics and it's important to know the words to the song. And other ones say, no, that's BS. So I didn't know, when you're playing a ballad, are you thinking of the words or just the mood, or how does that work?
Well, here's why the words See, I would never say BS. So the players that say that, that lets me know there's something about ballad playing and something about art that they don't know about.
Okay.
That's, when a person makes that statement, it lets me know that they know the peripheral of, I don't know if they know the soul of what any of it means. Okay, now, when you deal with lyrics, all it is, lyric, when you're dealing with ballads, if there are words to the ballad, usually these ballads, in this, you know, like the American song, but there are words to it. So words give you information. What kind of information? Well, they're giving you what is the story, because the words and the music are telling a human story. So what is the story that the words are a metaphor of, and the emotions, and also the notes are a metaphor of the for the emotions. Okay, so that's the information. It's emotional information, which allows a performer to at least understand what the composer was thinking and what the words mean. Because when you approach improvisation, there's a lot of ways to think of it. I mean, there's not just one way to think. Okay. And when you know what the story is about, then you can say, okay, I can approach it this way, that way, and you know. So it's valuable information other than the note itself. See, because you got to realize, and here's what I mean by that. Music is just an extension of the human being. Music is part of the universe. And music and the elements of what makes the music music is the human being taking the information, the physical information of music, and making that speak, using the music to portray the muses, to portray the emotionality, portray the human being feeling. That's what music is. Just like it is no more than that, no less. You know, we're talking about human beings playing music. So, you know, it's just part of the universe. I mean, we could take the elements of the universe and we can build, we as humans can build things. We're building things that's already there. Our human part is how we construct them and sequence and all that. We're not the atom and the neutrons and the protons. And all of that stuff is already there. We are doing nothing but taking the bricks of the universe and fashioning them in a certain way in building a house, a building, this or that. The elements are already there, and so is music. So when a person says, all I need is the bricks, then there's something about the equation they don't get. Now, having said that, it doesn't mean that you can't play a ballad and not know the music. Of course you can choose notes. But when you start dealing with the deeper aesthetics, I don't know if you're really doing... Can you sing opera without understanding the words?
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, you can. But when you know the words, isn't that information that's going to some kind of way inform choices that you make?
So even though jazz gets pretty abstract and you're playing, you know, harmonic choices within chord changes and the rest of it, what you're saying is, I think, is that it's the feeling and the inspiration and the kind of the meaning of the song. You can't really get that across unless you're thinking about and responding to that. You can't just play notes. You've got to be thinking about meaning.
Yeah. So the point is, yes, you can. You can physically play notes. Of course you can. But the but is, are these notes that you're playing from what part of the mind, what part of the consciousness of the being is playing the notes? So when you think of the human being, we think of the brain, right? Okay, the brain is an interesting piece of meat. Consciousness is expressed in many different ways. And you have the senses. You have all, you know, you have touch. You have sight. There's a lot of, when you make choices, it can be choices from what part of the choices that are coming from the subconscious, from the conscious. You got all of these layers of mentation that's available to you. Which one do you want to use? For instance, when I choose a note to play, I can choose a note based on the prechoral cortex of my brain. I can choose a note based on my analytical mind.
Okay.
That's the part I want to use, which means I'm thinking the note. But I can choose notes that have nothing to do with my analytical mind. I can use the part of the brain that feels. So what I feel is giving birth to the note, not what I'm thinking per se. So it depends on what part of yourself is giving you, do you want to use to disperse the information? Now, we all know that there is a magic spot when you hear a performer, a singer, a player, or look at a work of art, there's something that comes across that's almost otherworldly. And you can kind of see that. And when you feel that and sense that, it has more gravity. I mean, for me, it does.
Right. No, I know I've heard performers. I'm in Sweden right now, and I heard a couple singers who were both technically very good, and one of them really impressed me, and the other one left me very, very cold, and it wasn't because it wasn't a technical problem. It was just one seemed to, I don't know, be more emotionally present, and the other one seemed to be more playing at it, and it just, you know, that makes a huge difference. It really does.
Yeah, it makes a big difference, and one, it comes from a different part of the consciousness. One of them, you know, look, there's part of the consciousness. Here's what, you know, when you get deep into the stuff, some of it is this. There's a, like your analytical mind, that part of yourself that you're thinking is one thing. Intuition is another part of the mind. It's not the same thing as the analytical. Intuition is actually higher than that. The analytical mind is a funny part of the mind. It's the mind that's shackled with the necessity of empirical experience.
Right.
That part of the mind is in time, in three-dimensional time and space as we know it. That part of the mind tends to work like if I'm a man, I think this. If I'm a woman, I think this. If I'm 20, I think this. If I'm 50, I think that. If I'm black, I think this. If I'm white, I think this. If I'm Chinese, I have this way of thinking. The analytical mind is a slave to the empirical aspect of what life is, because it just takes it and makes this so-called decision here and there based on everything you've experienced. But now that's only that part. There's another part of the mind that has nothing to do with three-dimensional reality as we know it. It's got something to do with what Carl Jung talked about when he used the term collective unconscious. The Indians are talking about when they say akashic records. What some people are talking about when they say the astral zone. There's a part of the mind that's connected to this bigger universe out there that has nothing to do with empirical experience. It's got something to do with every ounce of knowledge there ever was in the whole universe. And that part there, when people plug into that, it's beyond your empirical experiences. You're plugged into the same thing that people like Nikola Tesla was plugged into, the same thing that Einstein. It has nothing to do with the analytical mind as we know it. And when the artist is plugged into that, that's how you get a Wagner, even though he was crazy as a loon. This is how you get a Charlie Parker. This is how you get that. All of this stuff is already there and you plug into it. And this is what I mean by when a player doesn't understand that deeper stuff, this is what I mean. They understand the words, but they don't understand the music.
Okay. We talk a lot about records on this show. Just kind of that's the unit we look at a lot because it's something as just listeners we can access, think about, replay.
Yeah.
I was just curious because, you know, we've heard dozens of sessions from Prestige.
Yeah.
What was it like to make a record back in the 60s on Prestige? I mean, what was the process you went through? Did you rehearse? Did you just kind of show up to the studio with sheet music or how did that work?
Both. We did show up with the music. You had to do in those days. You only had about 3 hours.
Okay. That's pretty quick.
to get it together. So we would come in, you'd learn the music. Maybe you would rehearse before you get to the studio. I mean, that was one way to try to get more time in. And then, but actually, once you got in the studio, you only get about 3 hours to get it and cut it. And then those are days, I mean, the first were analog, you know, it was no digital. Right. You know, you don't have a lot of time to nail it. And so that was a tricky, that's a hard thing to do. And also a hard thing to do is to loosen up in the studio because this is for posterity. You know, this is, you mess up now and people are going to know that you messed up, you know, 50 years from now. So that's a hard thing to do, is to feel at ease and relaxed in the studio, to overcome nerves, to overcome the narcissistic aspect of the whole thing. It's very hard to do that. And I had trouble doing that. I mean, it was I never was at ease at that. Now, I'm a little better now with that. But that's something that people have to overcome. And it's not easy. You know, Miles Davis had a way of doing what he would do. Of course, he's Miles. This is when Miles had money and power. He would, you know, come in the studio. And this is Columbia Records, right? And he would just say, turn the tape on and don't turn it off. So he goes in there with Train and whomever else. And they sit and do stuff and probably mess up or either it's great, or this next tape was wonderful, and the whole thing has been running. So you're going to get something good, and that's it. But how many people can do that? I mean, this exactly. is Miles being able to push his weight around and do that. Now it's a whole different thing. It's digital. It's a whole different thing. But yeah, that's always been kind of a tricky thing, is to be relaxed in the studio, even in this day and age.
Yeah, I know some artists like, you know, Sonny Rollins famously just did not like, never was very fond of being in the studio, right? And in fact, the most recent releases by him have been live air checks or, you know, things that he's released, but he just, you know, that bothered him. I guess it's harder to get on the astral plane or you know, kind of get beyond that the rational conscious mind if you feel under the gun, right? It's, you know.
That's exactly right. See, because that mind right there, see, the analytical mind is the one that's really, it's really there. I mean, you know, it's almost, you can't get out of that one. You can't get out of that particular, you know what I mean? Because it's everything around you is dealing with that part of things. You're dealing with mics, the placement of them, everything about that is very three-dimensional, Dick, Jane, and Spot, you know.
There you go.
For real, you're dealing with hardcore physics, you know, and physicalities and stuff. So, yeah, you're there with that. That's why when I listen to, you know, some of the older records, those guys only had 3 minutes to come up with the wealth of music that they did, and just go in there and analog and knock out that stuff. Those are some very talented people to be able to do that. But yeah, that to make good records is more than a notion, I tell you.
So you mentioned Don Schlitten, and we actually did a show on Xanadu, and we thought about his. So as a producer, did you work with some people that were better at kind of giving you some space to not worry so much about time and money and microphone placement and kind of look for inspiration? Was he good at that, or have you worked with other people that are better at that?
Yeah, I thought Don, you know, when I look back on him, he was very extremely a good person to work for. He never was bothersome. I mean, he was technically savvy. He wanted to get a good sound in the studio. He did make suggestions, but he was always democratic, smart. He was a beautiful guy to work for, to tell you the truth. And he really believed in the music. You know, the kind of music we played and he featured on his label, emotionally, that it resonated with him. It wasn't just business and pushing numbers or any of that. He really felt and had something for that genre of music. And he was beautiful, actually, to work with.
Yeah, he really, you could tell, because, you know, you wouldn't start up a label like Xanadu in the 70s if you didn't really love bebop. I mean, no one, it wasn't, you really had to fight for that, right?
Right, exactly right. And, you know, during that period, a lot of the guys were into, like, being a lot more conscious of playing music that was more easily listened to by the public. being concerned about the money part, you know, the business part, which became more of a prominent thing in the mind of musicians. It was more than, oh, I just really want to play great. It was like, oh, well, yeah, that's good too. But like, what can I, how am I going to, what makes money? I mean, you know, what about the money part? Let me make some. So that became part of the menu, or part of the ingredient, the equation started to be more and more part of what it is. And I always felt that, look, there's a lot about this kind of music that's still to work within this language, that you'll never run out of things to say. This language here is like English. There are new words that you can add, but that's wonderful, but it'll never fail. It works. You know what I mean?
Right. You can express a lot of different thoughts with English, not just one or two thoughts. Yeah.
Every emotion that a human being can feel, the English language has got a word for it. So that, I mean, I'm just using that as a metaphor.
Sure. No, right.
So bebop to me has always been a style. But first of all, let's think about it. It's just a word, number one. So if you forget about the word and phonetics, what the word means, just look about what it actually, how musically, how does it behave? And all it is rhythm, time and space, harmony and virtuosity. And those things are all of the things that music is, melody, harmony and rhythm, at a very high level of virtuosity, basically, to pull it off. And within that umbrella, under that genre, that umbrella, I can't think of any music that accommodates as much variety of style that can be housed under that umbrella. I can't. I mean, when you think about that music and think about all the players, there are players who play 1,000 notes a second, like Dizzy Gillespie. There are players who don't play many notes, like Chet Baker. There are people that play like Bud Powell, Oscar Peterson. They play a million notes a minute. There are people that don't play a hell of a lot of notes, like Ahmad Jamal, for instance, or say Bill Evans or somebody. That you got such a style, such a variety of style. You got people like Charlie Parker. Then you got people who don't play many notes. You got people who play very dissonant, people like Thelonious Monk, who is about as dissonant as you could get. You got people like Barry Harris, who's nothing like Monk. I can't think of any genre of jazz music that accommodates as many different styles. Certainly not Dixieland. Certainly not fusion. I mean, how many styles of fusion alto players that you can say, oh, there's this style, and then this one, and here's this one. I can't think of it. So,
right, yeah.
But when I think of bebop, I can think of basically, even though when you think of bebop, you don't really think of Paul Desmond, right? But really, he is part of, that's all part of that same movement in the 40s, in the late 40s, middle 40s. It's part of the whole thing. Charlie Parker's not like that. I mean, he's very different. Than. So I'm saying under that umbrella is... you know, that music formed all these different people. Yeah, it's a very broad-based music. And so that's what I mean by, look, there's a million styles that can occur within that, and all of them can be different from each other. So there's nothing wrong with the language of bebop. You can add to it a new word, new tunes, but it's something, you know, I mean, because what the hell is it anyway? It's like, the ability to be melodic and harmonic and rhythmic with virtuosity. And you can play a lot of notes or not many notes. You can be dissonant or you don't have to be. Now, what more do you want in terms of breadth? So, yeah, You can jump to money making music. You can say, oh, let me play electronic music and I'm just going to play some butt shaking music. Okay, well, good. But you're not there. So how much variety are you going to have in that? Really? Are you going to be able to do all the muses? All of the whole menu of human emotionality in butt shaking music? Really? Really? How many is there? How many ways is it to shake the butt? So you're dealing with a narrow band of a human emotionality, you know, party time. Okay, that's part of what a human being is. There is a such a thing as party time. Okay, but what about deep depression? Do you get it there? No. Or what about mystery? You get it there? No. What about when a person is thoughtful? What's the word? Pensive. That's a human emotion. What kind of butt shaking is that? In there, genre that pensive is going to be used. None. So this is what I mean. There's nothing to be. All of the human feelings are capable with that music. Sadness, gaiety, happiness, mystery, sexuality, sensuality. Everything is there. Round about midnight, that's as deep as one. You know, right there, all the way to Charlie Parker playing Coco. Now, yeah. look at the depth of emotionality that's available there in that music alone. So that's why I said, I can do it if I want to, but shoot, I can stay here, develop my own style, have my own sound, and never run out of things to do.
Right. And you certainly, so right, as we listened to your music, you know, we saw that during that 70s period when a number of musicians kind of went into fusion.
Yeah.
Or electronic music, you didn't. And of course, a lot of them actually came back to the bebop language in the 80s and beyond. So, you know, I think a lot of people agree with you that it's a kind of a flexible umbrella or language that a lot of different people can kind of be under a big tent and express themselves in. So that's interesting.
Yeah, it's broad. I think in terms of dimension, I can't think of any particular, if we're going to just, actually categorize and put something, music in a box, and then put it in a bebop box. I can't think of any box that allows for the dimension and variety of style than that box. Right. And when you put all the other musics in their own respective boxes, I don't think you have the dimension in any of them like that.
Cool. Charles, we should probably start to wind it up here, but okay. I don't want to close up without talking a little bit about what you've got going in the present and in the near future. Can you talk a little bit about the Lincoln Center retrospective that's going to be happening in your honor, I guess, in what, the spring of 2018 or February or something?
I think it's 2019, so it would be my 80th birthday.
Oh, I got you. Okay, so what's tell our listeners what.
Well, from what I know about it now, I will be honored along with McCoy Tyner. Also, it would be Wednesday. You know, the Lincoln Center Big Band will play maybe two of my original tunes, and I'll probably play with them. And then they're doing the same thing with McCoy. So that's 2019 for my 80th birthday.
Cool. And what do you have any studio projects that you're working on now? Are you working on an album? Are you recording something in the near future?
What I'm doing is with the San Diego Ballet Company here.
Right.
And of course, my daughter's one of the principal dancers. So I've already written for them, for the ballet a couple years ago. I did something last year. We did the same program again this year. I'm writing some new music for the ballet, and we will perform it in May. So I'm like the composer in residence at the San Diego Ballet.
And has that been, I saw the first of those gigs, and it was fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah. Is that a kind of composition that you like, is it difficult? Is it different or harder to write?
Well, it's a little bit different, you know, because you got to keep in mind you're writing for dancers, you're writing for movement. And so there are some things that you, you have to keep, you be aware of, and you do negotiate the music a little differently. You're doing as opposed to me just writing for, you know, trumpet, saxophone, bass, piano, drums, and I'm writing for us, and we're going to play, we're going to improvise, and we're going to take the tune out, and that's it. You have to certain things have to be very set because the dancers are not improvising.
Right.
Yeah, there you go.
And is that so in a way you're still kind of learning here in your late 70s?
Yeah, there's a way that you have to do the balancing act of the improvisational aspect and still have that part of the composition. But also there are certain, you have to balance that with certain things that happen the same way all the time.
Right.
And right. It can't be nebulous. It's got to be very definite cues that the dancers use. And so you have to be aware of things like that. It's not like it's hard, but you have to know, you have to be aware of that and then do it.
Right. Will there be another event here in San Diego like there was, I think it was last year, I think it was Gilbert Castellanos, a local trumpet player who put it together, jazz at the classical at Copley Hall here in
San Diego. Yeah, he's still doing that. I'm not involved in that. But there is something that I'm doing on there's a private benefit concert.
Right.
Then might have told you about. So that's coming up. I think it's on the 28th.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm doing that. And then of course the ballet, new music I'm writing for the ballet to be formed in May. I'm doing that. I'm working in Temecula too. Do you know about Temecula? That there's a little.
I know where it is. I know there's a winery up there, but I didn't know you worked up there.
That's a little performance space right in town, right in the middle of the town. A performance space called the Merkel or something like that. I'm doing that. That would be next. That was in January.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you're always getting gigs where you're a teacher in residence or traveling around.
Yeah, I travel a lot. I do clinics. I'm getting ready to go to Europe in March. Oh, by the way, I go to New York in March also. I'm at Dizzy's Coca-Cola in March, and I'm playing with great New York musicians, Jeb Patton, piano player, David Wong, bass player, Jonathan Blake, great drummer.
They put that on Sirius. Those shows often come on the...
Yes.
If you get satellite radio, so that may be a way people could hear that.
That's true. And there's an Israeli guitar player that lives in New York named Yotam Silberstein. Very good guitar player. So that's our band at Dizzy's Coca-Cola in March. And then later I go to Spain and England. And then in April I go to Denmark. What part of Europe are you in?
Yeah, I'm in southern Sweden. So I'm actually an hour away from Copenhagen.
Okay.
By train. Real close.
I might be going to Sweden. I think I'm doing something in Sweden and Denmark.
Right.
Yeah, well, let me know about that because we'll come out if we can for sure. Okay. That'd be great.
So okay. Basically, you're not going to retire ever, is what you're saying.
No, I don't want to. I mean, if I don't feel it now. You know, I don't feel. The only thing now that I'm. It's like airplane travel is a drag, but that's a drag if you're 19 years old.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a drag, you know. I mean, there's nothing fun about it. The whole bit, the security, taking shoes, security line. All of this. So that's a drag. I mean, I can do without that. But the playing of music is. I still love doing it, and I can do it. I can play the horn really loud. And
oh, I can vouch for that. Charles has come to my class to play for my class, and man, did you fill that room? It was.
Yeah.
It was uncanny. So yeah, you got to sound as big as a house.
And I don't have any problem with breath. You know, I mean, I can play long lines and not because I don't smoke. You know, I don't do any of that stuff. So I feel like I'm a 40-year-old man. You know, in terms of playing the horn. All right, then. So I hope you guys got enough. I hope it turned out, everything turned out okay. Pat, it's nice meeting you, and maybe I'll see you over there in Europe.
Yeah, great to talk to you. We really enjoyed it. It was fantastic.
Good. All right.
Thank you.
Good. All right. I'll see you guys, and we'll talk later on, Michael.
Absolutely. Take care, Charles.
And that concludes episode 132 of the Jazz Bastard Podcast. As mentioned before, if you want to find more information out about Charles McPherson, go to www.charlesmcpherson.com. There's lots of information there. You can contact us, as always, at mike@jazzbastard.com or pat@jazzbastard.com. Or you can look up our scintillating Facebook page. Or if you'd like, drop Pat a line at All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com or from Apple Podcasts. And a monthly summary of the podcasts with players embedded appears each month on All About Jazz. Tune in next time when we return to our usual format and look at work by Julie Wood, Vienna Art Orchestra, The Necks, and Alex Sipiagin. And Alex, I apologize, I'm just not going to get that name correct. A fine Russian trumpet player. Until next time, take care.